All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Joe Sinnott on the line with us here. And I've got my Make Coal Great Again shirt on, and one of my favorite shirts of all time, because it, to me, it symbolizes so much. Because a lot of people, of course, their perspective goes one way. But for me, I always argue that maybe coal will figure out how to activate it and it'll solve our drinking problem. And that sort of thing. So, you know, we start thinking outside the box with coal. Yeah, we can make it great again. And, you know, you're from Pennsylvania, so I don't have to tell you anything about coal. With that, Mr. Joe Sinnott, how are you doing today?
Doing fine from here in Western Pennsylvania, Jason.
Now, there was an event that happened over the weekend in Pennsylvania. Obviously, I'm wearing the Make Coal Great Again. I was even looking for my hat, Make Energy Great Again. I wanted to be very thematic with our discussion today, which is going to center around Saturday, July, was it 14th or 13th, the events that happened there, the attempted assassination on President Donald Trump. How far away are you from that? You're probably a couple hours, aren't you, from that Butler area?
About 45 minutes from the location of the incident that you referred to.
So talk to me about what you experienced, how you found out, how close you were. You weren't there, were you?
Was not there. Nope.
Okay. So let's talk about, you know, kind of you were close. So your proxemics, you know what I mean? Help us understand by osmosis, just kind of the vibe of the area, if you wouldn't mind, just to, you know, from what you experienced and everything, what you heard, what your neighbors are talking about, and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, the state, you're kind of boots on the ground for me here.
Sure. And I guess, you know, maybe if you start at the state level, Jason, you know, I think everybody knows that Pennsylvania is about as purple as they come, about as swing statey as they come. And, you know, even here in Western Pennsylvania, you know, it really is a balance. It really is a mix of blue and red, if you will. So, you know, Butler, Pennsylvania, where this occurred, you know, definitely more rural. So, like I said, about 45 minutes outside of Pittsburgh. I'm just outside the city limits of Pittsburgh, where I'm talking to you today. So obviously, you know, a little bit bluer in this part of the world. But by and large, Jason, I mean, you kind of got it all here. And it's, you know, you typically don't even have the, you know, maybe the extremes, if you will. In fact, you know, there's an anecdote from a couple of years ago, a CEO in the energy industry who moved here from California. I asked him, I said, hey, you know, what's your take so far on this area? And that was his take. He said, wow, you know, he said, it's amazing how you kind of have all perspectives, all sides, and you can kind of work together more so than, say, in some other polarized or more polarized portions of the country. So I think to set the stage, Jason, again, more rural, but when, you know, you get within that, say, you know, hour radius of Pittsburgh, you really get it all, right? I mean, you really have, you know, the full spectrum there. So in terms of me, I mean, I think, like, you know, a lot of Americans there popped up on my phone. It was my mom. I think she was watching some of the coverage there, and she had moved out to Western Pennsylvania, and, you know, certainly knew that he was talking up north, and said, hey, there were shots fired. And like most people, again, you hop on. And in this day and age, it didn't take long to see what had actually happened. There was, you know, not a lot of speculation to say, man, it looks like he was clearly hit by something that resembled gunfire. So again, I don't need to rehash that for the rest of Americans, but, you know, whether I was 45 minutes away or on the other side of the world, you know, instant access to this information, which is amazing in many ways. In terms of, I'd say, sort of the perspective on, again, that area, as I said, you know, more rural, certainly, you know, more Trump country than you get where I am right now. But again, Jason, you know, you start looking at, you know, the makeup of the area, and you just, it's one of those things you would never expect it to happen, right? You don't expect it to happen there. I mean, he was in relatively friendly confines. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that was a lot of people's reactions, which is, huh, here? Why here? You know, and from a local here, you know, it's some, why, you know, those are some of the initial questions. So I'll stop there, Jason, because again, obviously I don't, you know, with the rapidly developing story here, I certainly don't have any more insights than others have. But hopefully that kind of sets the stage.
The reason we kind of wanted to bring you in here is to talk a little bit about the organizational failures that happened, because conspiracy theories aside, facts aside, social media videos aside, something went wrong and there was a lot of fail safes that failed. When the Secret Service is involved, and somebody died and people got injured, you know, let alone what happened to the president. But there were fail safes, whether it be the 1,000-yard perimeter that the Secret Service is supposed to cover, whether it's the different zones that they have and the local police. And we've heard so many different areas. Like I said, from an organizational standpoint, Joe, the bottom line is a lot of fail safes fail. From an executive coach, how would you even handle something like this if they were to contract you to come in and say, Joe, whip us into shape here, executive coach style? Seriously, where would you start with any organization, whether it's an oil company, whether it's the Secret Service, whether it's a donut shop? Okay. You see what I mean? I mean, there's a reason for processes. There's a reason for regulations. There's a reason for organizational structure. How would you even handle something like this where it literally goes so far off the tracks that you don't even know where to begin?
Yeah, well, the easiest place to begin, and again, it's almost cliche, it's communication, right? You know, from the initial stories, and again, the stories that continue to come out, if not facts at this point, is that clearly there was, you know, tons of opportunities for communication that did not happen. Communication about what people saw and people that were saying things, again, locals that were there that spotted something that was amiss. And clearly that information did not flow to people that could have made the immediate decision, you know, out of an abundance of caution to pull them off the stage, even if it wasn't a threat. So, Jason, whether it's an organization and you're talking about, you know, more figurative harms and hazards, or whether it's a situation like this, that's where you start. And you say, all right, well, what are the barriers to communication? Why didn't that information flow? You know, you can have the cliche, see something, say something, right? That was popularized, what was it back around 9/11, right? You know, with terrorist attacks or the threat of terrorist attacks, see something, say something. Well, when people see something and they say something and it doesn't flow to the people that can make a decision, something's wrong. And again, I see it all the times in organizations. And again, I think it's on clear display from the events that happened just a couple of days ago.
Another angle is people were saying that whether it was an inside job or whether people decided not to, to take action when they should have taken action. Somebody's up on a roof. Somebody that brings a ladder and a gun to a presidential type of an event, obviously something went wrong there. And so from a managerial standpoint, from an executive standpoint, very often the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. Mm-hmm. And so it could be something as simple as a manager just decides to go into business for themselves and they start using the company's resources to, you know, do whatever they want to do. That's pretty common, Joe. And especially in today's day and age of social media, you and I have talked about all the side hustles that people are doing. And now whether it's an inside job on this Donald Trump deal, or it's trying to, you know, go get some side brand, side company started on your own, special interests are special interests. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, and you end up having chaos internally as an organization. How do you handle something like that when literally the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing and the middle takes advantage of it?
Yeah, well, a couple thoughts on that, Jason. The first is, you know, what is the end goal of an organization, right? I mean, what is everybody working towards? What is success defined as? Because when you don't have that and people can, you know, do the bare minimum of their job, check the boxes, remain compliant, you know, do what they're told, you know, hey, I signed this task to that person. They're going to go do it and get it done. And I'm going to wash my hands of things, which again is some of what you're starting to hear now come out on the heels of the assassination attempt. You know, when that happens in organizations, it's often because, you know, people don't have a sense of the big picture and how they can contribute beyond, how they should be contributing beyond just their assigned tasks. And if you leave a void there and, you know, give people an opportunity to say, hey, you know, as long as you get this done, you know, you could do whatever. Again, if that's almost implied, well, people are going to do whatever, right? And they're not all going to be working towards some ultimate goal, which in this case would be what? You know, protecting the former president of the United States. So, you know, that's, again, sometimes it sounds really cliche, Jason, but that's where you start. What are we working towards? And if you do that, you know, you get away from just complying with some given task, some given checklist, some given set of rules, and you empower people to say, hey, what are all the ways I can contribute to this mission? Without that, you know, people are going to walk around with blinders. And, you know, if it just so happens that, yeah, somebody's, you know, crawling across a roof that shouldn't be there. Yeah, well, you know, what are you going to do? It happens.
So when you have this kind of misinformation that social media can give, or the legacy media, actually, I think the legacy media gave more misinformation than social media did on this recent event. When you take a look at some of the headlines that came out of some of the different areas, and I know some people have even gotten fired because of it. So when misinformation creates chaos, a lot of time that's referred in the media as wildfire. You know, it's hard to start a wildfire. It's hard to stop a wildfire. It's very easy to start one. A little spark can start a wildfire. But a wildfire is often called the horse is out of the barn, is another phrase or cliche that gets used. Is there any way for an organization to stop the wildfire of rumors and the telephone game and misinformation, you know, on something like this? The only choice that President Biden had was to have a State of the Union press conference type of a thing to say, okay, we got to get all back on the same page. If you're a CEO, if you're a manager, is that what you do, is just call an all company meeting and say, hey guys, the horse is out of the barn. The fire's too big. We got to rein this in. How would you recommend that?
The short answer is yes. If you have an opportunity to communicate directly to the people that need to be communicated to, you take advantage of that opportunity so that, again, you can control the narrative. Where that misses, though, Jason, and many opportunities that are missed, certainly within companies, within organizations, is that, you know, going into that conversation, there tends to be a finite, almost, you know, black and white view of what you can say and what you can't say. And what I see far too often is leaders who don't have an ounce of creativity of saying, hey, look, you know, we don't know all the facts. I don't want to speculate. So we're just going to say no comment or something to that effect. Whereas, again, a half an ounce of you know, basically predicting and knowing what questions are going to come, and a half of ounce of creativity to say, OK, how can I address this in a way that, again, sticks to the facts, that doesn't speculate, but acknowledges what people are thinking? And I'll give you an example, right? You know, you referred to some of the early headlines, right, of some of these traditional media organizations who are, you know, getting, spotlighted because that, you know, even though it was pretty apparent pretty early on for anybody that had the, you know, incontrovertible facts of what happened, that it was, you know, an assassination attempt, you know, were very slow to make that headline. Well, how could they have responded? You know, what else could they have said to say, you know, apparent assassination attempt? I mean, just throwing that one word in there could have preserved their credibility without, you know, saying something that wasn't true, right? But instead, again, they play the extra cautious card. They perhaps damage their credibility. And it happens the same with CEOs, with leaders, where, again, they take this oversimplified black and white view of what they can say and can't say, and don't introduce an ounce of innovation. And again, some of that takes practice, Jason. And some of it is just, again, it's a very simple question. Hey, what are all the ways I can address this in a way that's factual and not speculative, but that also satiates the very real concerns of my audience?
Sometimes when you have an event like this, you know, the momentum can swing you to where you go a little too far. And, you know, with something like this, that can happen in business pretty easy too, where all of a sudden some momentum gets going. And, you know, all in the state of Wyoming, one of the former state representatives and I used to joke, because North Dakota is a lot similar. In fact, Dustin Goverlow, the North Dakota Watchdog Network, was just on statewide radio talking about this very thing, where sometimes it's a good idea to have a little bit of pushback, because then your dumb ideas don't get through so fast. You can actually have a little more communication and conversation. And, you know, when you talk about a political structure, of course, that really means a lot. But I think internally too, when you're talking about a business and a structure, it's good to have some open dialogue, and it's good to have some, you know, not gridlock, but a little bit of friction, if you will. That's what keeps things moving. How can an organization get away from groupthink? I'm not saying there's groupthink right now, but obviously a lot of the Republicans at the national convention are very much on the same page, and we're as close to a groupthink with an organization as possible. And sometimes that can be very dangerous, just because if there's a dumb idea, nobody has any talk about it. It just gets through. So two-part question. Can groupthink identify a dumb idea? And how do you handle it if it's kind of there? And by the way, this has nothing really to do with last weekend. I think it has more to do with the state of Wyoming and North Dakota, because we joke often about, you know, there's hardly any Democrats that serve the people anymore. So that's more of that type of a question. But talk to me about the groupthink and how to slow down that type of momentum when needed, because it's obviously needed for a reason, but it can go too far sometimes. So,
yeah. And to your point, again, this is universal, right? And even in, you know, even in individuals, right? I mean, you can have groupthink within a family or within a relationship, right? Where it's easier to just kind of plow through and just keep moving forward and not really question things. Or when those questions do come up, you suppress them. And, you know, because again, it's easier. So what I try to help leaders do within organizations is almost desensitize people to, you know, sharing their dumb ideas, as you might say, right? Get to the point where people can almost joke and say, hey, what if we tried this? You know, let's dream a little bit. And there are some, you know, discrete tools that people use. Anybody that's worked with me knows that, you know, one of the tools that I learned years ago from somebody that came in and, you know, was a consultant that came into an organization I was working for, you know, he shared this simple response. And again, anybody that's worked with me knows I really embrace this. And that is, Jason, when somebody comes to you with a dumb idea or a crazy idea or an out there idea, you say, you know, what I like about that. It forces you to your point, slow down, right? Slow down, think for a minute, acknowledge the other person. You know, again, don't do anything that's going to dissuade them from bringing up a future crazy idea. And you can almost laugh about it that way, because sometimes it's ridiculous, right? Sometimes the ideas that are coming out are ridiculous. But when I say desensitize, I mean, get to the point where people share a ridiculous idea. And if it, you know, you at least spend that 5 seconds on it if needed. But that's a cultural thing, Jason. It doesn't, you know, again, there's some discrete tools you can use, but, you know, leaders who want openness and innovation, they want all those buzzwords, right? Well, you got to take some actions to get there. And it takes time. And again, maybe desensitizing isn't the right word, but it's true. You get people laughing about the fact that they got some crazy idea, sharing it in a way that they're comfortable, and then having at least one person stop for a second and say, hey, what would it look like if we actually did this? That's how these things bubble up, right, Jason? So that's, again, it's not an overnight type thing, but like most things, it starts with a leader who can demonstrate it himself or herself, and who empowers his people to execute upon that, you know, desensitization and in turn encouragement of those ideas coming to fruition.
When we're talking about something as severe as this, and as many fail-safes that failed, There is the potential of whistleblowers now coming out. If you're part of an oil and gas company, the name whistleblower comes up a lot too. So from an executive's point of view, Joe, because, you know, this is why you get paid the big bucks. If there is a case where like a whistleblower is going to come up, how would you handle that? Because on one hand, and a whistleblower in like a corporation versus a whistleblower for the U.S. government, two separate things, right? A lot of times when it's for a corporation, the whistleblower is coming forward for more consumer protection, whereas a lot of times in the government, it's more for political power type of a thing. So if you're a CEO and, you know, I mean, tobacco company or oil company, and somebody's coming forward for some kind of consumer protection type of an angle, but at the same time, man, that could really put us out of business fast. You know what I mean? Like, because of the triggers we have in today's world, because of the overreactions. I mean, I grew up in agriculture, so I understood, you know, that you have to accept kind of the good with the bad, and hopefully at the end of the year, you've got a net positive. And if you have a net negative, well, you need some drastic changes, right? That's a very heartless and a very quick answer. But a lot of times in agriculture, that's the only way you could deal with it. I mean, there's very high mortality rate in agriculture for a very long time. Lot higher than oil and gas, actually. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, whistleblowers, how executives deal with it, how management, you know, that type of thing, because that's not an easy, there's whistleblower protection laws in there, for crying out loud. So sure. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the tough decisions within organizations when they arise.
Well, let me address that by talking about the differentiated leaders who, again, don't play the standard dancing around. Well, oh, we want whistleblowers. We want you to share. And then, you know, they give the impression that, well, you don't have the full picture. And it, you know, again, it creates all of this angst and anxiety for all parties involved. You know, that's the typical, right? The differentiated leader comes in and says, hey, I look at whistleblowing, if you will, as an opportunity that we can leverage as an organization. We're going to be that rare organization who truly, truly encourages and celebrates when these things pop up. You know, we're going to, again, to the extent possible, publicly share when these things pop up, obviously protecting, you know, the folks that are doing the whistleblowing clearly. But again, that fearless approach, that confident approach, that innovative approach, that, again, a word that I like to use from a book that I love, anti-fragility, if you've ever heard of that, Jason. Again, it takes this idea of saying, hey, look, when you know, bad things happen, and let's be frank, if, you know, if there's a legitimate whistleblower call to a hotline or whatever, then, you know, that's, again, not a good thing for an organization to get to that point. But how do you take full advantage of it? How are you in a position where you're not so fragile, again, as you were alluding to, Jason, where, yeah, some of this information that can come out can be severely damaging. How do you convey a sense of, no, we want these things so that we can act quickly and actually emerge stronger? That's what differentiated leaders do, Jason. And it's uncommon, unfortunately. But, you know, in my work with individuals, and certainly the oil and gas industry needs more individuals like that who say, look, let's uncover the bad news quickly and fully and openly and take the wind out of the sails of all of our adversaries or everybody else, instead of going into defensive mode. So Jason, that, you know, that's the key. That's the dream. That's the ideal. Easier said than done. Absolutely. But if you don't start with that ideal, it's not going to happen in an organization.
It's very difficult to remind yourself you're not perfect. Because a lot of people expect perfection on a regular basis. And I don't know if it's insurance companies or attorneys, or if that, you know, it kind of creates a situation where you almost have to walk on eggshells to be perfect. I'm not sure. I just know that has played into a lot of different people in the past. So if you're, you know, an organization, and you have something like this happen, you know, maybe it's a death of a CEO, maybe it's, you know, a whistleblower situation. It's a catastrophic, just jarring of something or another. How do you get everybody to collectively get on that same page and make sure that, you know, we can be positive moving forward? Because whether it's a doubt in your Secret Service, whether it's a doubt in your commander in chief, whether it's, you know, blind faith in your new path that you're going to take, there's still pitfalls ahead, Joe. You know, it's not, I mean, just because you've been, you know, slapped in the face doesn't mean it's done. No, now the work begins. Now the work begins. And so talk to me about that next step, because it's tough when you get kind of shock and awed a little bit.
Sure.
You can almost get lulled into a norm quicker. Does that make sense?
It does. I think I get what you're asking. And regardless, it all points to, again, the sometimes vague term known as executive presence. How do you exude executive presence? How do you exude confidence in your audience? And again, obviously it's situation specific, but by and large, Jason, it starts with ripping up the script, right? Connecting with people on a human level. You know, you could talk about Donald Trump, right? What, you know, what has been his appeal to so many people? Well, it's, you know, the lack of a teleprompter, right? It's connecting with people. It's focusing on the audience. You know, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, clearly, you know, the man exudes executive presence. People want to look at him. They see strength. Clearly, again, I mean, I don't know that you have, I don't know that you will ever have as good of an example of that as the, 2 minutes after he was shot in the ear, popping up, and everybody's known that, you know, known the, or has seen the picture, right? You know, the now picture that will probably live on in infamy there of him with his fist up in the air and his response to that, you know, that resonates with people. Whether you agree with them or not, I mean, that tugs at people and says, hey, this is the type of person I want to lead. Well, you're not going to get there when chaos ensues if you're following a script, if you're coming across as guarded, as overly polished. You know, it's in that moment, can you exude this presence? Can you do all of these things? And that's what you need more of. But again, you can't necessarily rehearse stuff like that, obviously. So Jason, you need to put leaders all the way down the line in a position where they can, in a moment, just say, wait a second. Again, forget the script, forget the talking points. Let's look at the audience. Look at my stakeholders. Let me talk to them as human beings. You know, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to go wrong there. Maybe you put your foot in the mouth here or there, whatever. That's fine. I know we live in cancel culture where, you know, you say something inadvertently and it could blow up, but you know what? Play the odds. 9 times out of 10, you look at your audience direct, in the eyes, tell them what the path forward is. Tell them what you believe. Tell them it's going to be okay. Or you know what? You don't know if it's going to be okay, but this is what you're going to try to do. I mean, forget the overpriced, consultants that are going to come in and advisors and come up with some big plan to reemerge from the ashes and all of this when something goes wrong. No, start by connecting with your people, trusting your people and treating them like human beings, Jason. And you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck than, you know, anything else that anybody else is going to dream up.
Is there anything that we're, just to talk about the Pennsylvania boots on the ground aspect of it? Is there, you know, anything that you're hearing that, you know, isn't really making the news at all, that anybody's chattering about out there, whether it's in, you know, this is more of a newsy thing than your role as an executive coach. So right now you're more of a news correspondent than you are a executive coach. But is it, you know, just from a boots on the ground type of a thing, any chatter that's not making it in the news at all?
No. I mean, and again, you know, certainly I've gotten those questions and texts from folks that are,
mosquito's been bothering me this whole interview. Finally got him.
Congratulations, Jason.
Thank you. Yes.
It's a good feeling there for you. The short answer is no. Obviously I think, you know, when I'm reading some of the stories and, you know, you see some of the coverage and the facts that are coming out, you know, maybe there's a little different perspective that I view it through, but in terms of information, again, we're in 2024, you know, it's, you'd be hard pressed to really claim that there's some boots on the ground stuff here. Certainly, you know, 45 minutes is a big way away too. I would imagine there's some people actually in the heart of Butler that, know some of the individuals that saw some things that, you know, and maybe some of those stories haven't gotten out yet, but I'm not privy to any of those, Jason.
A preview for a future conversation, because I want us both to prepare for the topic, but you know, you and I both kind of understand ESG, environmental social governance, and kind of how it affects everything. You know, I mean, we even did a show on it as Spice Girls. Tell me what you want, what you really, really want, because ESG is everything. Environmental social governance that, you know, you're basically circling the wagons on that. And part of that is the DEI, the diversity, equity, inclusion, equality, and inclusion. And that is part of the story that has popped up, where they have a new director for Homeland Security and Secret Service came in and, you know, started doing more equality with some of the Secret Service agents. And we saw some of the inexperience that happened in real time. And I was even listening to some of the past Secret Service people, and they said there's a reason why they try to hire over 6 feet tall, and they have military backgrounds, and they went into it, you know, because the height, it's good to see over the crowd, not under the crowd. And, you know, when they started getting into some of the actual reasons why, you know, that's a hard one, because again, if your finances and your cash flow depends on it, but putting it out in the free market, it's not equating to it. And then if it's actually causing health and security concerns, well, that is going to actually impact your insurance and other things going forward. So, I don't know if you have any comments on the ESG or anything along those lines, but I wouldn't mind doing a future show about that and talk a little bit more, because over in Europe, it's taken hold. In Australia and New Zealand, it's taken hold. And so ESG is probably going to be a major American issue next year. And we're starting to see some of it happen right now. So I'm not sure if you even take a look at that ESG and DEI part of the Trump assassination attempt, but it is part of the story, Joe.
Yeah, again, well, if nothing else, Jason, I mean, I think this is a good example of, you know, we can stick to the facts here, right? You know, whether or not we go down the path of talking about DEI, the facts are that it is definitely a storyline, right? You know, it's on display for everybody. You know, who was involved? Who was there on scene? You know, who was there charged with protecting Donald Trump? And in terms of, again, and these aren't original thoughts of mine, but, you know, the ones that certainly pique my interest are, hey, you know, it's one thing to broaden your pool of applicants or whatever, but the next step is, are you giving them the resources? Are you training them? You know, it's not fair to just, and in fact, I think it could be an oversimplification to just try and point to DEI, or just try to point to, you know, an individual, just try to point to, you know, one specific smoking gun, if you will, you know, when there are certainly lots of different variables. It's not just the hiring. It could be the training. Again, we talked about communication. We talked about protocols and procedures and misses. And very rarely do you have any sort of catastrophe or major incident or, you know, something that goes wrong. Again, whether it's in a corporation or whether it's, you know, something like what we saw a couple of days ago, very rarely, Jason, is there just one element? Is there just one thing to blame? But in our culture, where again, we're so, you know, what, fast moving and you know, we try to oversimplify things. You know, you just want to blame one person and move on. You want to blame one element and move on. But very rarely is that the case. And, you know, and again, watching this through the lens of leadership and oil and gas, again, I was reminded of, how many years ago it was now, but, you know, the anniversary of the Piper Alpha catastrophe from, you know, the 1980s. So, you know, what is it, 160, 170 people died. But again, you know, in that incident there wasn't just one thing that went wrong. It was a series of errors. Or conversely, it was a series of things that could have stopped that catastrophe from happening. So again, one of the most, if not the most well-known oil and gas incident, certainly in terms of loss of life. Obviously, you know, a lot of people have Deepwater Horizon in more recent memory. But again, just like Deepwater Horizon, same thing, right? Not just one cause of that incident, multiple causes and multiple fail safes that failed. So again, coming back to DEI, I think you look at it as perhaps a piece. You look at the hiring as a piece. You look at Secret Service leadership as a piece, but you would be very short-sighted and you're almost certainly going to miss key elements to prevent future incidents if you don't recognize that there are lots of different variables contributing to a massive failure like this.
Anything else that we're missing on this, Joe, from, you know, kind of from an executive coach standpoint? I'm trying to take a look at how to, you know, view this from a different angle, because so much of life is, you know, lessons that we can take to our work and our family and everything else. And there was a lot to learn. You know, there was a lot to learn over last weekend. You know, as we wrap up here, my biggest takeaway, honestly, because me, I try to look at things as non-political as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a Catholic, you know, I was an altar boy, and, you know, so I would say I was spoon-fed fear and guilt. So I try to, you know, take a look, you know, and actually I'm on my knees because I was Catholic, you know, we've got to go through the motions. But the humanitarian side of things, you know, I start seeing posts that, you know, the shooter missed by a millimeter, an inch, you know, they start promoting death, basically. That to me is going a little too far. You know what I mean? It's when you start taking people's lives and it's like a movie or a video game. That's a tough one, Joe. You know, for me, that was my biggest takeaway from last weekend was there was a lot of fail safes that failed. And so the organizational structure was a complete mess. There was people that went into business for themselves. That was quite obvious. But to me, you know, somebody died. And most people, not most, but there were a lot of people that wanted more bloodshed. They wanted the former President Trump to be part of that. And they would publicly just put it out on their social. I mean, Joe, they'd just put it out on their social media. I mean, first of all, two-part question now. If you're a boss and you go to your employer's social media account and they're promoting a 2-inch, you know, misdirection of the bullet, I mean, how do you handle that? And secondly, you know, I know your faith. So, I mean, obviously you look at this from a humanitarian side too. So let's, you know, bring it home from that too. But in all honesty, if you're a manager and you see that one of your employees, I don't care if you're at Walmart or if you're working for Exxon, that's a tough position to be in if your employee is now promoting that on social media. I don't think that's too far to say, do you?
No, and it's happening. And again, I've seen multiple examples of, again, what you're describing, right? People who are going out there on social media and, you know, lamented the fact that the shooter missed his intended target. What I'll say to that, Jason, is that, you know, I'm not even sure if there's an exception, but we'll say, you know, all, if not nearly all of the examples I've seen are pretty clear cases where, yes, if you were in management and that person worked for you, it would be ground for dismissal without a doubt, you know, shedding light into somebody that should know better. I mean, that gives more color on that human being. Again, you could say it was an immediate instinct, but when you look at it case by case, again, so many of the people I've seen, you know, again, just based on their background and the roles that we're in, you would say that is absolutely inexcusable. On the flip side, though, for, again, you know, you're talking from a humanitarian standpoint, as a culture, where are we, right? Where people would be so quick to say that. I think the very difficult thing for everybody to do is to say, all right, in what ways have I contributed to that? Yeah, that's a very tough question to ask, right? And obviously the story is, you know, one side's blaming the other side for rhetoric and everything else. But the reality is, again, it's an open question to say, hey, you know, in what ways have I contributed to that, even in some small, tiny way? Now, again, if we shift away from this and you look at a corporation, it's the same thing, right? When something goes wrong, or when you have people that are disgruntled, or when people are not doing their job, again, very rarely is there one easy thing to blame. Yes, from an extreme ownership standpoint, you know, if an individual screws up or an individual does something wrong or an individual tries to, you know, assassinate a former president, clearly, I mean, hey, that's the person to blame. But the reality is everybody needs to ask, okay, what impact may I have had in that in any small way? And what could I have done perhaps to reduce the odds of that happening in the first place? You know, that's an open, honest, soul-searching question that is much more difficult to do than just the old finger pointing, right? So again, you know, not to get on my soapbox here, Jason, I appreciate your question, but you know, that's how I'm viewing this. Certainly from a coaching standpoint, from a corporate standpoint, it's yes, there's these people to blame, but just because you exit them from the organization doesn't mean you have an excuse not to call into question how they got there in the first place, how you had somebody sitting there for so long who held this view of people that, again, is the opposite of, again, what your company is likely meant to be, especially some of those people, Jason, who I saw that were doing that were in service positions. You know, there were people that were in, you know, I saw a firefighter who posted something similar and has since either resigned or been fired. You see teachers who, again, are tasked with, you know, protecting children and helping children grow. You see people who work in, you know, healthcare organizations who are tasked with, again, helping people live and thrive. And for an individual like that to be in your organization who houses that instinct, you know, that, again, it might be a small failure, but it's a failure on somebody's part. And, you know, we as leaders need to recognize, you know, the role that we may have played in that. So anyway, that's, you know, you're getting some insights into how I view these things, again, as evolving and as, you know, late breaking as some of these things are. But, you know, that's how I'm seeing some of these things over the last couple of days, Jason.
Well, I'm Gen X, so I was raised, you know, on MTV and Dukes of Hazzard and Bill Cosby and, you know, that sort of thing. And Alan Thicke from Growing Pains. But also Friday the 13th. You know, I mean, what did they make, 13 or 12 of those things? At least, you know, 11 of them. And I got to be honest, that to me is what I compared it to. Because when you start to take a look at the, you know, after part 5 of Friday the 13th, it was more of the killing and more of the outrageous nature of how Jason was going to kill the victim than the actual horror. It became campy. And to me, that's what it seemed like. It seemed like people were, because when I would go to, you know, Jason goes to space or Jason goes to Manhattan. By the way, Jason has been to all the same places the Muppets have been to, which is a good, you know, a good thing. But the crowd would cheer when, you know, when Jason would kill somebody with a weed whacker, the crowd would cheer because that's why they went to see the obnoxious ridiculousness. And so, you know, that's part of the Gen X desensitization of that. I'm not sure about the millennials, the Gen Zs, who were raised a lot differently than we were, you know, because we had screen time allocations. We didn't have computers in the school really till our high school years. So it was a little bit different, but for me, that's what I thought of, actually. I thought of the Friday the 13th horror movies, how people would cheer the deaths in the later scenes, but that was the entertainment side of things. And Joe, I almost wonder if that's where we were on Saturday, is almost like when people were cheering and booing the O.J. Simpson victory, forgetting that somebody died, a family had died here. You know, we get so caught up in the nationalism or the competition, if you will, that we do forget that, you know, there is a humanitarian side of things. So not to be a Debbie Downer here at the end, but I thought we'd kind of bring it home a little bit. So I'm not sure if you have any comments on my Friday the 13th analogy, but that's where my mind was, because my name is Jason, you know. And it probably wasn't 13th. It was Saturday the 13th, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it was.
There you go. No wonder my mind was there, huh?
Here we go. It's all connected there. Yeah, I, again, certainly I agree. I guess the only other thing I'll say to kind of close the loop, again, bringing it back to corporations and leadership and communication, is that, you know, if you have a culture where you are basically desensitizing the gap between the written rules, the, you know, the right things to do and what's actually getting done, you know, the gap between the written and the unwritten rules, that's no different, right? It's no different that, you know, the further you go along and you condone people doing things that are, all right, yeah, that's not quite company policy. That's not quite what we have in our SOPs. You know, that's, you should not be surprised when you get to a point where something really, really bad happens. So it's no different now, Jason, right? You know, the more you say, hey, obviously killing is bad, you know, like promoting, you know, blood and murder and all those things is bad, but yeah, you know, it's all in good fun. It's just a movie. It's just the whatever. Yeah, 20th iteration of Friday the 13th or Halloween or any of those. You know, and again, it comes back to responsibility. You know, at some point, has somebody said to themselves, huh, do I have the power here to shake this up a little bit, to call people out, to do something about it? And if so, did they do anything about it? Did they actually call anything out? Did they change their behavior? If not, again, you know, they are complicit in the end result. So again, culture, movies, oil and gas, same problems that I see, and all roads lead to leadership, being aware, asking the right questions, and, you know, not forgetting what the, you know, their ultimate goal is, which isn't, you know, just, you know, boosting share price by X%, right? You know, mm-hmm. It is This is still doing the right thing while also making a profit. You know, those things are not mutually exclusive. So anyway, I don't know if that helps or sheds any, again, additional color on how I view things, Jason, but.
There's really no right or wrong answer or anything along that last one, because it's more of just processing. A lot of this is processing. And I know you do, where are you at? The Society of Petroleum Engineers, Society of Petroleum Engineers, you just got done with earlier. Are you got any other speaking events coming up? Are you doing the podcast still? Talk to me about what's going on professionally for a minute or two, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, still host a couple of the, those SPE, Society of Petroleum Engineers, as you just mentioned, their tech talks there live. They got a couple a week. Again, I'm one of a couple of hosts that do those. So still have a couple of those on the horizon. Podcast, The Energy Detox, is taking a little break here for summer. So we'll kick things back up with a new season as we get closer to fall, as we've done the last couple of years now. So excited to get that rolling again. And, you know, most of my day-to-day, Jason, is still helping leaders make better, more conscious, more effective, more timely decisions. And again, you know, kind of playing on some of the themes we've talked about today, identify threats, identify barriers, and identify ways in which, you know, they might be unwittingly opening themselves up to harm, opening their companies up to harm.
Might have to do an NFL preview next week, because you've got Russell Wilson and sorry, did you disappear? There we go. You have Russell Wilson and Justin Fields. So you've got you know, two star managers, you got two star CEOs. So we'll have to, you know, executive coach how the Pittsburgh Steelers are going to handle this year's season. In fact, I even saw a prediction on the Rich Eisen show that they might have two 1,000 yard rushers. So the Steelers, we'll have to talk a little bit about that and some other things. But Joe, any final thoughts here as we kind of close shop for this week, for this month?
Well, I think the only final thought, Jason, if you're going to bring up sports, I would be remiss as a representative of Pittsburgh not to say that, you know, for once, we're actually going to wait a little bit to get all excited about football season, because the Pirates are still hanging on. You know, we've made it to the All-Star break. The Pirates are 500. They're still flirting with a playoff opportunity. And they've got what many would say is the best pitcher in baseball, that being the rookie Paul Skenes. So, again, a lot of excitement here in southwestern Pennsylvania related to the Pittsburgh Pirates and, you know, maintaining some hope, if not false hope here, a little bit later into the season than we typically do. So for anybody who isn't familiar with the Paul Skenes phenomenon, check it out. Even if you're just a casual baseball fan, if he hasn't hit your radar yet, it's a pretty cool story about a generational talent. And again, in this day and age, and everybody's looking for, you know, something uplifting and undeniably positive, knock on wood, you know, as best as I could tell here, you know, a couple months since he's been on the scene, you know, it is truly a positive, cool, neat story that, again, I think people should go ahead and check out if you're not already familiar with.
I just predicted yesterday on the radio that he will get Rookie of the Year and Cy Young. I believe he'll get both this year, which would be, I think, unprecedented. I don't know if it's ever been done, but maybe it has. But that's the type of talent we're talking about here, where he's already in the conversation for Cy Young, and he's, I think, 1,000 lock right now, minus 1,000 or whatever. Plus, I forget how it works in gambling. I don't gamble. I like it too much, so I'm not allowed near it. So I, something I figured out in college at a very young age, and I decided, okay, well, I'm going to stay away from that, or I only keep $100 in my pocket, nothing else. So I got to leave the casino. We'll talk about that another time too. So anyway, but hey, Joe, appreciate the time today, sir.
Great. Well, thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure.